My name is John Avery, and I guess most of you have been in one session or another during the week. Just very briefly for the tape, I'll introduce myself. I teach at Pacific Lutheran University. I teach English as a foreign language there. And I was in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia for 5 years doing the same thing there. I also, before that, in 1974, spent some time in Israel and have been in different places in the Middle East, such as Cyprus and Turkey and Jordan and a few other the other Gulf countries. And I say that not to brag about traveling, but just to give you a sense of some of the travels I've been on, because it relates to the topic for today, which is really how does the whole Middle Eastern context affect the stories. It seems like a given, of course, that Jesus was a Middle Easterner. He was a Jew. He was a person coming from the ancient tribes of Israel and was imbued with the sense of that history and religion. But for us, halfway around the world, in a very entirely different culture, I think it's often very difficult to get back into that and to get a sense of what it was like. So I've been intrigued by this book, which has helped me to reflect on my experiences there. I put the title up here on the board. It's actually two books in one volume by this author, Kenneth Bailey, Poet and Peasant and Through Peasant Eyes. And it's published by Erdmann's of Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's a small publishing house, but a very good one. And what this author, who he is he's had far more experience in the Middle East than I have, and in a much better way as far as related to biblical stories. He was raised, I think, as a missionary child, and also went back himself to Beirut and taught for 25 years at the Near Eastern School of Theology, I think it is. And is fluent in Arabic and probably other languages in the Middle East, and has gone out and really searched for himself this question of how can we understand Jesus better, how can we understand the parables, particularly the parables, better within the Middle Eastern context, and it seems to make a lot of sense to me. Constantly while I was there, I would see things that just astounded me with their authenticity of, oh yeah, that makes more sense. I was drawn to the phrase, for example, drawn to my gates with thanksgiving. And every house in the Middle East is walled. And when one enters the gates of a friend's house or the headman's house or whoever's house you enter into, you are in a sanctuary. Now that we kind of lose that sense in our suburbia areas where houses kind of and lawns kind of flow one to another. But when there is almost a nationhood almost of a family from one to the next, that those kind of verses come alive and seem to make sense. I really understood what Pharisees were like when coming across the religious police in Saudi Arabia, who wanted exactness on everything, a hair length, and whether you drank during the month of Ramadan or not. And, you know, it didn't matter if it was your religion or not, you had to observe the religious law for everybody. And long beards, very, what I would call sour looking faces, wizened and very stern. And it seemed to convey that sort of personality that most frustrated Jesus and certainly most frustrated me when I was there. And so Bailey does a very methodical approach to this, and that's what I want to get into today. And this really fits in with a lot of what I was working with this week. Some of the themes of what I've tried to convey is a sense of the Middle East and an appreciation for their culture and viewpoints. And we've looked at a lot of that by looking at Islam. And yesterday we talked about the Islamic view of Christianity. We also played a cultural simulation game earlier in this week that was a lot of fun, Bafa Bafa, where we took on the attributes of different cultures, and one group went to the other room, the other group stayed here, and then we played off against each other, each learned a different culture, and then we had to exchange visitors, and they were operating on different rules. One was a trading culture that was intent on getting their money, their chips or cards or whatever from one another, and the other was a much more patriarchal culture in which the relationships were very important. And it was all very artificial, but it's amazing how well it worked, and I think many of the youth attended, that was really, really an interesting experience for them, and for me it was great. And also another theme this week that I've tried to stress is that Christianity is a Middle Eastern religion. And many of the assumptions that we have, or many of the meanings, I think, of Christianity are hidden behind a kind of cultural veil. The veil, I think, is an appropriate symbol here. There's a real person behind those veils, a real people behind those veils, I should say, but they're somewhat out of sight, kind of like the houses and the families behind those walls. But they are knowable, and with some work and some extrication of the things, we can get at them. Okay, what I want to work with this morning is one particular parable, and I chose it because it is particularly difficult. It's called the Parable of the Unjust Steward. And I've prepared these handouts, so I hope there's enough. If there isn't, you might have to share it with someone next time. I want to do this first, and then I'm going to go into what Bailey says about it. Is everybody able to get a copy, or one for every two or something? I think there'll be enough for that. Okay. But take a minute to read through it. It's the first half of the page. I've organized it a little differently, as you can see.
Can we read it aloud for those who can't?
Sure, absolutely. In fact, would you like to read it aloud for all of us?
Luke 16. There was a rich man who had a steward, and charges were brought to him that he was wasting his goods. And he called him and said to him, "What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward." And the steward said to himself, "What shall I do, because my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and ashamed to beg. I know what I will do, so that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their own houses." So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And he said, 100 measures of oil." And he said to him, "Take your bill and sit down and write 50. Then he said to another, "And how much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat." And he said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. Then the master commended the dishonest steward because he acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light.
Now, I think this is a very difficult parable, because it seems that Jesus is commending dishonesty. Here this steward goes around and he cheats his master. So before I get into this too much, why don't we work together, say in small groups of three or four, and go through these questions and see what you come up with. There's 12 questions here. Let's take about 10 or 15 minutes for that.
15 minutes for 12 questions, okay.
Well, some of them are real direct.
Oh, okay.
And I don't think it will take too long. It will take as long as it needs to be. Okay, maybe we can try to attack some of these together. What's your general feeling after going through this?
It helps to talk about it.
We don't know much.
Yeah, there's a lot here, isn't there?
You're going to tell us a lot.
Hey, I'm new at this. I'm not a Bible teacher. I usually, you know, deal with English grammar and past tense and stuff like that. So bear with me, please. This is not my forte. Anyway, what's the owner told about the steward? He's dishonest. He's cheap.
He's wasting his goods.
So in some way... Okay, it could just be being inefficient, but it's enough anyway to get the guy in trouble. What's the steward managing?
His wealth,
but in reality, what's that mean? Is he as a banker, or is he a...
product.
He was managing the resource.
Business manager?
Debt collector.
Debt collector in a sense, yes. Steward... Yeah, what kind of things does he call for later on, I think, as a help? Oil and wheat. Mm-hmm. So I think it's land. He's. I think the setup, and Bailey goes into this, is more or less like in the South where you had sharecroppers. And the steward is the master's overlord, going over and kind of picking, you know, arranging for the collection of bills. And often the way the bills were paid, how were bills paid? I didn't have that in here, but...
10% of what you produce, or some percentage of what you produce.
Yeah, so it's not in a monetary sense, but in the goods, right. What does the owner do in verse 2?
Fires
him. Right, he calls him on the carpet and fires him, right. what could the owner have done that he didn't do? Could have given him another chance.
He didn't hear the other side.
Didn't hear the other side.
He didn't investigate.
He could have fired him immediately and not given him a chance to go back and change the account numbers.
Okay. So we have one group of people are saying he could have done more mercy, and you're saying he could have been more strict with him. Even a further step to being more strict, which maybe would have been expected in the Middle East, is he could have thrown him in jail.
Yeah.
Okay. How does the steward interpret the owner's action?
He panics.
Yeah.
Well,
what does it mean for his life?
He
won't have anything else to do. Why not?
Because he doesn't know how to dig.
He doesn't know how to dig. He it would be too humble to beg.
He's not strong enough to dig.
Okay. And too humiliating to beg. Right. And so what will happen to him after this?
He'll start.
He'll start, right. Is anybody going to take him on in a similar job? No, because he's too distrusted. He's not a good steward. Right, he won't get a good recommendation. And in the village atmosphere of the Middle East, that fact will be known. There's no way he'll be able to hide this. He won't be able to go to New York, you know, and fit into the millions that are there or something. So he's kind of stuck. Okay. What does the steward arrange with the debtors?
Cuts down what they owe.
Cuts down what they're owed. The action is considered shrewd because
he's got a place to go then.
Yeah.
He can be friends with the debtors.
Okay. Sure, right. And so he's ingratiated himself to them.
Does he profit by when he cuts this down, as one bill to half and another one to eight?
No, he's not pocketing the money.
Does he profit anything there?
He's no.
Just making friends.
I think he's just making friends. Right. Okay, do the debtors know what has transpired between the owner and the steward?
No. We don't think so.
No. And I think within the context of the story, they aren't told. We're going to go into that. We'll let a few of these things hang for the moment, but we'll go back into it in a minute. What's the master's response? And the master commended the dishonored steward because he acts rude. It seems like an odd response for the master.
I mean, unless those are bad debts, then he got something rather than getting nothing.
And that's a possible interpretation. I don't think it is.
But if it's sharecropping, then it's not bad debt.
No.
Yeah, that's right. It's only something to pay your
percentage of. And also, these are not bills that are due at the moment. They are due in the sense that when the crop comes in, they will be due. But so we wouldn't know if they were a bad crop or anything like that. I don't think he's just helping out those who had a bad business or had a bad year or anything like that. Okay, considering his response was expensive, why did the master respond as he did?
Recognizes one of his own, you know. You're
a little
boy, you know.
It's a possible interpretation. Uh-huh.
He thought it made him look good. The people that he, the steward gave the advantage to, sort of make the order look good too, because they don't know who it's coming from.
Exactly, right. And if they don't know who it's coming from, the steward, remember now, the debtors don't know that the steward's been fired. They think that this is an order from the master. So, I think what you're getting at is that, so what would happen if the master turns around and says, no, no, the steward didn't represent me?
Oh, he'd be countering his order.
Right. Have you ever said to your children or to someone you've been in charge of, we can go to the zoo, and then later on you say, no, we can't, and they get disappointed and you have some very unhappy people, and it's much better to not say it in the first place, or if you do say it, you have to carry through on it. And I think it's that same kind of setup, is these are people under charge and they've been given a tremendous discount here, and so for the master to go back and say, no, a mistake has been made here,
it would... States.
Yeah, he would lose status, exactly, right. What does he gain by being generous?
Goodwill.
The goodwill of his debtors, right. And which is essential within the context of a village that operates on a legal basis but also on a social basis. Also, we have to remember that it was the debtors who first informed the master that the steward was cheating or was mismanaging the business. I think.
It's also possible that through that creation of goodwill that the debtors would produce more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
But still, here it wasn't a percentage of what they... It was a strict amount. It wasn't a percentage of what they grew. It was 50 measures of wheat and 80 measures of oil.
Okay. Bailey works that out through figuring out how much all that was worth in the Middle East to being worth a set amount of 500 denarii. So I think what the steward was doing was acting very quickly and saying, oh, let me chop off a set amount from everybody's bill. Mm-hmm. And he worked out how much that meant for oil and how much it meant for wheat, right? Okay. Number 11 is probably the hardest. How can this parable reconcile with a biblical sense of honesty and justice?
I had this explained to me once, and whether it's right or not, I don't know. But he was, the amount that the people were forgiven of their debt was his commission. And so he was shortening his commission that he got for managing the master's fees. The master was losing nothing, but he was taking a lesser amount of commission. So I don't know.
Okay, that's a possibility. I think Bailey discounts that, and this is only one man's interpretation, but I'm kind of coming from where he's doing this and just saying that the steward was paid a set amount and that he wouldn't get it if the accounts were collected at the end of the year anyway. But that may be an interpretation. Okay, any other?
If he put ourselves into that situation of the steward, then that takes on a different meaning.
Okay.
On our relationship to the owner, the way we handle things as stewards, not so good stuff with stewards, and then all the way down the line, and that we are then in top of it, still be willing to forgive.
Giving them from his own pocket, he's forgiving him from his master's pocket. The steward doesn't lose anything. He's only ingratiating himself to the debtors. I can see your point.
The relationship still may have been strained that he has to go through such extremes in order to do that. alienation, some kind of it. Nothing has to do with that farm.
Okay, that's a possibility. I mean, the wonderful thing about parables, which is one thing I want to get into, is that parables are a form of literature, and like any form of literature, they're open to various interpretations. And I am always amazed that Jesus taught a significant amount of his teachings through parables. And that says a lot for lit majors and and writers and so on. Other things? Biblical texts.
I think sometimes what we think of as biblical honesty and justice is based on Northern European sense of what's just and fair, the more English, and we impose our values and interpretations on what may have gone on at the time, and probably this was a very shrewd, honest, acceptable, commendable way of doing business and interacting socially and economically. And to put our values on this and try to explain how this might be honest and right in our culture is kind of missing the point on the setting and the context of what how when the parable is told.
Okay. Any response?
I don't think it is commending honesty at all, because it's like he makes a comparison in the last verse. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are people of the light. That doesn't sound like a statement of commendation. It sounds like just a comparison that even the people. It's like the passage that it rains on the just and the unjust. That. Just saying that if the people in the world can deal with this, can make relationships and get along or whatever, then why can't you guys? Why can't you people of the light? Why can't you be shrewd in dealing with each other?
Is this in the context of Jesus? I don't know exactly where it is in Luke. I don't know what's gone before and what comes after, but maybe he's telling his disciples that they are going to meet up with all kinds of wild people. And that maybe sometimes maybe they better back off because they can't deal with it.
Okay. Okay. So we've got lots of good ideas. Robert.
I only come in halfway through, so I don't know.
Oh, well, that's all right.
But it seems to me that at the beginning of the story, the rich man had a steward and charges brought to him that he was wasting his goods. This was somebody else telling the rich man, so it was by somebody else's mouth that the steward was condemned. It doesn't sound as if the steward admitted any bad stewardship. And then what has happened at the end is that it is by the steward's mouth that the good, so it's got nothing to do with dishonesty or anything. The steward has illustrated to the master that he shouldn't have been condemned by other people's voice, in the same way as the debt should not have been forgiven by the steward's mouth, the debt of the master. So it doesn't seem to me, if that's the case, that it's about.
Okay.
It's kind of like, is it Tamar posing as a prostitute to show Jacob that he has done, have I got the wrong one?
Who? Not Jacob, Judah.
To show Judah that he has treated her badly.
Whoa, you guys are great. You've got a lot out of this that I didn't see, which is one of the wonderful things of having groups at Holden. Okay, well, what I'd like to do is kind of talk for a while about what Bailey says about this and see if we can kind of bring some of this stuff together. And I think it helps to look at some things that he does. The parables, again, appeal to me because of a number of factors. Intuition, I just... know that, his approach to the parables appeals to me in a number of ways because my intuition of knowing about the cultural background, the context, and literary background. We don't really learn a lot about literary styles and structures a lot, and I'd like to go into that a little bit here. Bailey, first of all, takes a look at how parables have been interpreted in the past. He he says that for a number of centuries, the main form of parabolic interpretation has been allegorical. The steward represents the unjust man. The owner represents, you know, the state or some other form. And it says that that's an inadequate way of looking at parables. Two other things have been tried. One is historical, considering the context, and one is looking at the literature, which means that you look at the whole range of things that people look at when they're looking at literature. Symbol, characters, form, style, compactness of words, themes, and so on. Just as when we look at Shakespeare, we have to consider the world into which Shakespeare wrote and what the literary styles were at that time. So in searching out a meaning for this, he goes through a number of steps. One thing is he tries to discuss the parables with Middle Easterners in order to get that cultural, historical background. And he has a whole range of Middle Easterners, and he has criteria for them that he wants to understand. That first of all, they had to have been born in the Middle East, lived in a village, a small village, such as those that Jesus spoke to, and so on. Second, and he has other criteria I won't go into. Another thing he does is he looks at ancient literature and the forms that are used, and we're going to go through some of that. Another thing that Bailey does is he looks at Oriental, in other words, Arabic versions and other versions of the Gospels to see how it was presented on other translations. He says that in dealing with the cultural problems, people have a tendency to do a number of things. One is they allegorize. They deny culture, that there is only one meaning, again, the steward represents unjust people, and so on, and just forget the whole cultural context. Another thing is to indigenize, assume that first century people are just like us, that the relationships are the same. Kind of what I did when I said that the steward was like a sharecropper, an overlord of a sharecropper. I said that because it helps us to understand. But if you carry that too far and you just deny the culture that it was given into, that's just making them like us. Another thing is to universalize, saying all people are the same in all cultures. There's really no differences. Jesus was the Lord of all. God is the God of all creation, and that he's speaking to all people at all times. And in a sense, of course, that's true. We do share problems, but the patterns for expressing those problems are different at different times. Another way of denying culture is to deny the historical context and say, just, gee, what does this mean to me? How does this speak to me as an individual? Another one is to despair, say, there's no way of getting at this. The cultural layers are so thick, it's rather like archaeology in the Middle East, that where they have to brush pieces of pottery off with a paintbrush type of thing, that there's no way of an ordinary person getting into that. And the fifth another way that Bailey proposes is a reconstruction of using that ancient literature and his Middle Eastern informants to get at the meaning of the parables. And first of all, he says that the parables as a form are a theological tool in themselves. They are not just merely examples of a point. When we give examples, they usually follow a point. In teaching my students writing, I teach them examples are never given first. One of the problems that students have is they give an example and then elaborate on it. But usually examples follow a point, or a quote follows a point. But that's not what they are here. They're not a point, a separate point to be made. They're not an example of a separate point to be made, but they are a mode of religious expression. And the purpose of them is to directly produce religious faith, to produce a response in the hearer. C.S. Lewis talks about literary forms, and I thought I'd bring this in. He reiterates some of the things that Bailey does, but a lot of us are familiar with C.S. Lewis, a British scholar and theologian. When he wrote his book on the Psalms, and he says that the Psalms, which have a form of poetry in them, have a wise provision in them, and I'll give you a quote here, a wise provision of God's, that poetry which was to be turned into all languages should have as its chief formal characteristic one that doesn't disappear, as mere meter does in translation. So the Psalms don't rely on, you know, meter of a certain rhythm and so on, but they rely on a parallel form. And so it is with so much of the biblical literature. For example, Lewis uses this example of the language of Jesus. For with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged, and with what measure you met, it shall be measured to you. There's, in a sense, no logical addition there, but the repetition echoes with variation the first point. And you get sort of another angle on it. It's rather looking at a tall building. Modern architecture, I think, plays on this. So you can look at a tall building from one angle and it looks like a traditional building. You look at it from another angle and it's totally different. And it can be quite intriguing. So by having these different measures, the biblical literature carries through and through translation. Consider also the phrase from Jesus, ask and it shall be given to you, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened to you. Again, using different images, this is kind of the ancient literature tradition here. It's adding rhythm and a rather incantatory expression. Bailey picks up this theme. He looks at four different types of literary structures, and we're short on time, so I'm not going to go into all those. But he calls these pattern semantic relationships. Let me just give you an example of something that's not biblical, and then we'll go into this. And here we have a short dialogue. I'll read it because it's rather small print. A person says, are you coming to the party? B answers, can I bring a friend? A answers, boy or girl? What's the difference? What difference does it make, says B. A says, it's a matter of balance. B, girl. A, okay. B, I'll be there. All right, rather mundane little discussion here, but I think what it illustrates is that there's a, it's a rather strange dialogue if you don't, say if you, in a normal conversation, if you take off these things, which you would have if you were discussing it with one another, could you follow that if you were kind of listening from afar? Well, Bailey says that there's a form to this discourse, and it goes like this. It comes to the middle, and it goes back out. And the answers are given in opposite proportion to which the questions were asked. Look at this. Are you coming to the party? Another question is asked in response to that. Can I bring a friend? Boy or girl? Neither one of these are answers to the ones preceding it. What difference does it make? Okay, D, with the apostrophe, answers D. It's a matter of balance and answers that question. C, girl, and answers this question. B, okay. And A, I'll be there. We do this kind of thing all the time, really without thinking about it. Now, take this and apply it to 1 John chapter 1. See if I can carry this through. It's rather an intriguing thing. One relates to one, two to two, three to three, four to four, five to five, six to six. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was the Word. This one was in the beginning with God. And I think this sort of structure and variations on these structures are throughout biblical literature. And Bailey, as you can imagine, in a rather thick book, analyzes this, and he comes up with these four different things. Longer or shorter sections of prose that use the inversion principle for an outline. That's what I just showed you. The second one is poetic sections that use a variety of parallelistic devices, rather like, you know, seek and you shall find, in a variety of forms, and he identifies seven of these. Another one that has type parallelism in the center but encased within a set of matching sections of prose. And finally, the parables in Luke usually follow a parabolic ballad form that is distinct from the above. So he does a lot of analysis in looking at ancient literature, and I think brings a lot to us in terms of what's there. Okay. So that's the literary structure. Let's go look at some of the cultural clues, and this is going to relate to the unjust steward because we're running out of time and I want to try to pull this together. This, first of all, is very much a problematic parable, as we've discovered in going through it. The steward is the estate manager. He is the representative of the owner. He is a man of authority, the steward is. The owner is, of course, but so is the steward. He collects the rent and annually at harvest time. One of Bailey's informants reflects on it like this. He says, "Thus the owner requested the manager to present to him the contract signed by the farmers and countersigned by the managers in order to show how much was owing to the owner by each partner from the produce of his field." And the word partner here is important, that the steward is collecting from partners. So there is a social relationship here between the owner, the steward, and the debtors, or who we may, this Middle Easterner calls the partners, because they are all together in this venture. I think there's maybe even a sense of a village community here, and it's easier to understand being at Holden. Okay. And walking through this parable, the owner was informed of the cheating by the steward, which was a response of the partner. Someone had to tell him. And in the context here, it must have been one of the people who knew that somehow the steward was being an unwise manager. In looking at the structure a little bit, I think we can see the way I've set this up here. That there are these parallelisms that are there for each of the parts. And the climax of the story comes in the middle, as most stories do. "I know what I will do so that when I am put out of stewardship, they may receive me into their own houses." So this is what the story leads up to, and the rest of the story is an explanation of his decision here. Okay, I'm not going to take the time to go through this because I want to leave time for a few questions. Let's see if we can work through this. All right. What happens then is immediately the steward is summoned when it's found out that he's wasting his master's goods. This is a typical kind of situation in the Middle East. If someone finds out that you're not doing your job, you're summoned in and expected in a rather father-son kind of relationship to give an account. And he says, "What's this I hear about you?" It's rather direct and accusatory. "Turn in the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward." Immediately the man is fired, and this is what happens there. And I think a significant thing, and that Bailey draws attention to, is that the steward does not say anything in the presence of the master. This is an admission of guilt. Typically, and it's a very loud situation, in the Middle East, if you're accused of something and you feel like you have not been well represented and someone doesn't know, you know, your side of the story, you argue vociferously and loudly about the situation. And I think the steward knew that he was found out here. And so he plans to do some damage control, to put it in our own terms. And he knows at this point that the master could have jailed him, could have thrown him right in there and wouldn't have to justify it, because the community knows that the steward was being unwise and wasting the master's goods. So he knows, and this is the key, he knows that the master is merciful. And I think some of you were getting at this in your comments. And so he's going to try to get, in very shrewd language, try to get as much mileage out of that mercy as possible. And this is what the rest of the story illustrates. He takes a risk on the mercy of the owner. He summons the debtors. Now, in this situation, the debtors do not know, as we found out, do not know that he's been fired. Only some of them know that the master has been informed. So he's taking a risk here, the steward is, and he summons the debtors one by one, and that's significant, one by one, so that they're not talking to one another. It's rather like the police, when they pull some people in to give the testimony after a crime, they don't pull them in together and question them, they pull them in separately, so that they can play one against off the other. So I think what he's trying to do here is find out what each of them knows, in a sense, and not have them informing each other. And he summons them. He has the authority of to calling them in. And in the context of the story, he's rather abrupt with them, almost rude. How much do you owe my master? He's taking on the voice of authority, which he really doesn't have anymore, since he's been fired. But the master told him to collect the books up. And very quickly, he's going through this because he knows his time is limited, and he knows that the master is going to want his accounting done very quickly. And so he cuts off a set amount. And as I said earlier, Bailey figures that out at about 500 denarii, whatever that means, for each of them. So he mets out the owner's mercy. And so he does that for two here, and I think that's probably a representative, and tries to endear himself to the locals. Okay. The master, in finding out what happens, commends the steward for acting shrewdly. And he knows at this point, as we talked about, that he can't go back on it now. He's committed, that this man was his spokesman. What he probably should have done was gone and collected the books himself, if he wanted to prevent this kind of thing. And in the context of the Middle East, Bailey says that this story would be well received because it's kind of a David and Goliath story. The little guy wins through some kind of shrewdness. And it's illustrating the principle of how much more. How much more will God have mercy on us? Sort of thing. How much more can we expect? And the key here is if the dishonest steward solved his problem by relying on the mercy of his master, how much more will God help the righteous? Now, all of us may not come to the same conclusions with this, but it seems, I think, to make sense. And Bailey relates this to the larger context. Let's just take a look at it. In Luke for a second, Luke 16, because I didn't copy it all off here. And I went rather quickly, I know. Following this is the parable, very interestingly, the prodigal son came before it. Had a lot that I wanted to work into this. See if I can. I just can't find my note on it. But anyway, I think it's operating on those principles and working with it. Now, there's a lot there, and I'm trying to condense a large presentation, but I think what we have in this kind of approach to biblical study is what Bailey has been a pioneer with and other people are doing now. There's a man at PLU, Doug Oakman, who's been there a couple of years, who's also doing the same kind of thing and being more methodical about it, and it's rather a cultural anthropological approach to biblical study in considering the literature and the context. Does it seem to make sense? Does it help? As I said, I'm new at Bible studies, so I'm hoping to bring some of the Middle East to this kind of approach. Because I think in studying the Middle East, we can not only see, again, a perspective on them, but they give us a perspective on our own religion, which comes out of that context. We just have a couple minutes left. And any questions or thoughts or comments, reflections?
How does the steward know that his master is going to be so merciful? Isn't he taking a big risk?
He knows it because he didn't jail him. Yeah, and he is taking a big risk. He's getting deeper in trouble here. Because he's actually been fired so that he could be put in jail longer or punished more. So he is relying on the master's mercy.
If the steward knew that he was fired, why would he still make an account?
Well, it says he has to make an account. So while he's making an account, he's making a deal.
Yeah. Bailey says usually what happens is that the master doesn't even give the steward an opportunity to do this kind of juggling of the books because he's afraid of exactly what happens here. But this master was a little more merciful than most, and he gave him a chance to work things out.
Well, he may not have been able to understand the books, too. And he needed the steward to do it. The culture is full of haggle as well, isn't it? So
possibly, although, that's a possibility. He may have wanted that information from him. For some reason or other, anyway, he gave the guy a chance. But it does seem a very curious parable to begin with, because, I mean, here, you know, a man is dishonest, and he's praised for being dishonest, in a sense. But within the context of relying on mercy, it seems to make sense. Okay, well, that's it. Thank you for coming, and I appreciate it.
Do you want these back?
No, you can.